From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a people power movement sweeping over steamy Hong Kong this month, and it has mighty Beijing worried. On July 1st, 6 years to the day after Britain handed Hong Kong back to China, 500,000 people took to Hong Kong streets. But they weren't celebrating the anniversary. They were marching against tough new internal security measures that, if implemented, would import mainland-style social controls. They were marching, in effect, for democracy. It was the largest protest rally in China since Tiananmen Square in 1989, and a potential rallying cry for democratic sympathizers across China. But Beijing has not cracked down yet. Tonight on Point, China's big trouble from little Hong Kong. We begin tonight in Beijing. Hong Kong's chief executive, Tung Chee Hwa, is scheduled to fly to the Chinese capital on Saturday to brief the Chinese government on the crisis in Hong Kong. Calls for his resignation have been ringing in the southern city, but Tung has vowed to stand fast. Pro-democracy protesters won a victory today when two of the most unpopular members of Hong Kong's cabinet resigned. Joining me now, live from Beijing, is Philip Pan, correspondent for The Washington Post. Good evening and welcome, Philip Pan.
Good morning here from Beijing.
Yes, good morning there. Thank you so much for joining us at an early hour. Philip Pan, could you just give us the basics, set the backdrop for this latest news today? What kicked off this great political allergy in Hong Kong in the last couple of weeks?
Well, this is something that's sort of been building for the last 6 years. The public has been quite disappointed with the government, especially its handling of the economy. The economy in Hong Kong is doing quite poorly. Property values have dropped by two-thirds since the handover. The unemployment is up to a record high of 8.6%. It was just announced.
Very high for Hong Kong.
That's the highest it's ever been. So the economy is sort of the underlying issue, but the proximate sort of spark that triggered these protests would be the government's attempt to push through the internal security legislation that would, as you said, bring in some of the types of police measures that are permitted in the mainland into China, into Hong Kong. And there was a year of public consultations about this law, but there didn't really seem to be a real effort to listen to public comments on it. A lot of suggested amendments to soften the bill were not accepted, and the government sort of took the attitude that they could get this passed in any way. So that triggered quite a response from the public, and I think the government was quite surprised.
So the Hong Kong government and Beijing were both taken aback when they looked out and saw 500,000 people gathering in Hong Kong on July 1st?
That's exactly right. The Hong Kong government had always argued that most people in Hong Kong wouldn't care about this bill, that they only cared about the economy, not about politics. They reported that to Beijing. And so Beijing expected the same. Now, when they woke up on July 1st and saw 500,000 people on the streets, Beijing was quite upset, I think, with the Hong Kong government.
Is there now an expectation among the people of Hong Kong that their chief executive may, in fact, resign, despite what he's said today?
Well, I don't know if there's an expectation, but there's certainly a desire. The organizers of the protests, the pro-democracy opposition, many members of the opposition, are pushing for him to resign. The question becomes, well, what happens if he resigns? Would China allow Hong Kong to have some type of greater or wider election to select a successor? This chief executive was appointed by Beijing, and there are a lot of people who believe, if Mr. Tung steps down and Beijing picks just another person, that's not going to fix things at all.
But wasn't Hong Kong
executive that's accountable to the people?
Wasn't Hong Kong effectively promised at least a shot at the opportunity to elect its own leader just a couple of years from now in the documents that led to it being handed back to China?
Well, it was in theory, it was promised in sort of the vaguest terms possible political reform that could lead to a direct election for their leader in the year 2007. The government in Hong Kong hasn't really moved to begin public discussions about the legal changes that would be necessary to bring that out. The Chinese government certainly has not been eager to move forward on that process. Again, it's a vague promise, and there's no set date for it to happen. And the Chinese like to point out that there's no rush, that Hong Kong was ruled for over 100 years by governors appointed in Britain, and that they don't see any need to change that system right now.
How big a problem for Beijing are the protests, the pushback in Hong Kong?
Well, they're certainly caught the attention in Beijing. I don't think it's become a huge problem yet for Beijing. This is something more that they're just worried about. They're worried, you know, traditionally Hong Kong has served as a base for revolution and subversion in the mainland, and the Communist Party itself used Hong Kong long ago to disseminate propaganda in the mainland when they were banned there. And so they're quite aware of the danger. They don't want to see these protests spread to the rest of the country. But right now, I think, you know, this party has a pretty good grip on things in the mainland, and they have certainly banned all reporting about the protests in Hong Kong.
And how to break the logjam with Hong Kong? They're kind of betwixt and between right now. Are they going to try and just play rope-a-dope, put off a decision, and hope that the protest goes away?
Well, they could do that. There's another possibility, because we have a new leadership in China right now.
Just a few months in.
And a lot of people are wondering whether this leadership is going to be more flexible, more willing to experiment with political reform than the past one. A lot of the people in Hong Kong are making the argument that democratic change in Hong Kong should not be a threat to what happens in the mainland, that what they're asking for is democracy in Hong Kong, and that democracy in Hong Kong doesn't have to mean anything bad for the mainland. And there's at least a slim hope that the new leaders in Beijing might be willing to accept that. The other possibility is that this plays into some type of power struggle within the top leaders of the communist government here, that one group of reformers may, or not even reformers, but one faction may be able to use this against the older faction that appointed Mr. Tung to the governor, to the chief executiveship in Hong Kong.
Philip Pan, thanks for the update.
Thank you for having me.
Philip Pan is a correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us from Beijing. We're talking tonight about China, Hong Kong, and democracy in the balance. Did you know this month's pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong were the biggest in China since Tiananmen Square? Can you imagine mighty Beijing worrying about pro-democracy protests in little Hong Kong? And if Beijing can't tolerate a little democracy in Hong Kong, what hope does it have of ever going peacefully democratic in the mainland? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Hong Kong is Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. Good evening, that is. Good morning there, and welcome, Keith Bradshaw.
Well, thank you.
Good to have you. Good to have you back on the program. Also joining us from Washington is Veron Hong, China Program Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good evening and welcome, Veron Hong.
Yes, good evening, Tom.
Thank you very much for joining us. Keith Bradshaw, to you first in Hong Kong. You just heard Philip Pan in Beijing describing the view from there. It sounds as though Beijing is a bit of a bind here. If they respond liberally to this, allow the protesters to win the day, open the door toward more democracy in Hong Kong, they must fear that might spread to the mainland. If they crack down, they must wonder what they're going to have on their hands. What's the mood in Hong Kong right now? Are people optimistic that the public protests have pushed things onto a good track or not?
I think there's some optimism. The real question is, how high have expectations been raised? When the July 1 march took place, the number one goal was to obtain real changes in the internal security legislation. At the very least, they've now pushed that back a long way, with the government announcing yesterday that they would postpone legislative consideration while they do a whole another round of public consultation. The last round of public consultation took about 5 months. Now, they haven't said how long this one will take, but certainly they are showing more flexibility than has been the pattern in the past. The problem for the government is that having been emboldened by their ability to draw large crowds on July 1, pro-democracy leaders have understandably raised again the question of, well, what about universal suffrage? What about electing the next chief executive in 2007 by a popular vote of everybody in Hong Kong? What about the fact that right now only 24 out of 60 seats in legislative council, rising to 30 out of 60, I guess, next year, are elected by the public, while the rest are either chosen directly by the government or are elected by a few pro-Beijing, mostly pro-Beijing industries and professions. So the goals have broadened with the initial successes, and the difficulty for the Hong Kong government and for the Beijing leadership behind it is to figure out how to make enough concessions to mollify enough of their critics to quiet things down without making so many concessions that they either spark greater hopes here or spark greater hopes on the mainland.
Keith Bretcher, Hong Kong has been famously focused on commerce and industry for many years. The kind of cliched characterization was that people there didn't care that much about democracy as long as they were doing good business. Has that changed? Have Hong Kong people in large numbers become concerned that or politicized under these 6 years of oversight by mainland China and Beijing?
I think there are two answers to that. One is that they were never quite so apolitical as a lot of people wanted to think. Mm-hmm. And second, that the economy, as Philip was mentioning, has played a big role in making people more upset and more willing to go into the streets in general. First of all, as far as the history of this, there has been chafing at the unrepresentative nature of the local government going back arguably all the way to the 1920s, if you look at the Great Strike of 1925. But certainly beginning in 1983, you had the first fairly large pro-democracy demonstration by some of the same people who held the demonstration on July 13th. Now, fairly large. We're still not talking large by Western standards or even by standards of the past 3 weeks here. One issue was that the British, under the public order ordinance, banned gatherings of more than three people, except with permits, all the way up until the early 1980s. This was a very repressively run administration in some ways.
I must say, from personal experience, that was not very often enforced, but I have no doubt it was on the books.
Well, it was on the books, and so you had this question sort of whenever you were organizing something, whether something would, in fact, get approved or not. But anyway,
our time is running down before the break. Let me just turn to Varun Hung for a moment here. Varun Hung, what's going on and what's not going on in Hong Kong right now? Is this a kind of a people's power push for democracy? Is it a people's power push against Beijing?
Well, no. First of all, we have to understand that we don't want to mistake what anti-Tong sentiment in Hong Kong for anti-Beijing sentiment.
You said anti-Tong, that is anti-Tong Chi-Hua,
the chief executive.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, I'm actually originally from Hong Kong, so I'm fairly confident that this is actually correct. Because actually, if you look at recent developments, the recent visit paid by China's Premier, Mr. Wen Jiabao, he was warmly welcomed by the residents in Hong Kong. And then I think in the words of the Independent Popular Oriental Daily, in Hong Kong, it's that one connected with ordinary men and women in Hong Kong in a way our current leadership cannot. So then this is quite telling.
You're saying the Chinese premier was more popular than their own local appointed leader, Tong Chi-Hua.
That's correct.
You also point out that there was a poll done, I'm not sure if it was by the Oriental or someone else, but a poll last August saying that among the most admired men among Hong Kong citizens were Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and Zhou Enlai. So it's not as though it's a wholesale rejection of China.
Exactly. So that's the reason why Hong Kong people should emphasize that, and this is very important in terms of Beijing's take on the political unrest in Hong Kong. If they take it as anti-Beijing, then they will show more resistance to Hong Kong people's demands. But if they take it objectively, this is actually their discontent with the current administration in Hong Kong, then they will be more open-minded and then more ready to satisfy, not fully, all the demands, but at least to make some concessions.
Maybe compromise a little. We've got to take a short break. Please stand by. Keith Bradshaw, Varun Hung. We're talking tonight about mighty China's trouble with little Hong Kong and the future of democracy in the shadow of Beijing. Have you been following the struggle for democracy in China's unique southern city? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about mighty China's trouble with little Hong Kong and the future of democracy in the shadow of Beijing. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Can you imagine why mighty Beijing is afraid of open politics in the former British colony? And could Hong Kong infect all of China with the democratic virus? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. I'm joined tonight from Hong Kong by Keith Bratcher, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times, from Washington by Veron Hong, a fellow at the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a Hong Kong native herself. We're joined now from Irvine, California by Richard Baum. He's director of the Center for Chinese Studies and professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's author of Reform and Reaction in Post-Mao China, The Road to Tiananmen. Good evening and welcome, Professor Richard Baum.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Richard Baum, do we have the makings of another Tiananmen here? Is it possible that Beijing might see it that way, or is this in a different category entirely?
Well, what we have here, Tom, in some respects, is very much like the perfect storm, a combination of tide, wind, current, and fortune.
Well, I know it's a port city, but I don't think you mean water here.
No, I don't. This goes all the way back to 1989, when the Chinese, under duress following Tiananmen, promised to liberalize the political rules in Hong Kong gradually over time. Mm-hmm. They introduced stipulations into the basic law that would increase the number of popularly elected legislators gradually.
We've got a problem on that line. We're going to have to get right back to Richard Baum. But Veron Hong, you heard what he's beginning to describe there. Of course, in 1989, when Tiananmen unfolded before everyone's eyes, Hong Kong looked on in special horror because it was less than 10 years away from a planned reversion to China, and China made some allowances for their concerns at that time, as Richard Baum was pointing out.
Yes, that's correct. Well, in 1989, actually 1 million Hong Kong people went out to streets to demonstrate, to show some support for the students at Tiananmen Square. At that time, they fought democracy and show sympathy for the students there. And this time is different. They try to fight for democracy for themselves.
That puts it on home turf. But Keith Bratcher, how strong is the political infrastructure of the Hong Kong would-be political reformers? I mean, Beijing's influence is already great in Hong Kong. Can they come in and put the arm on people and quiet them down or not?
Well, I guess there are two questions there. As far as the political infrastructure of the would-be reformers, it is very weak. The party, the political party structure here is very undeveloped. They don't do a lot of fundraising. They have virtually no full-time staff. The legislative council members themselves, which is where most of these pro-democracy leaders work, have virtually no staff. This is not a government in waiting, as it were. To a great extent, also, the pro-democracy movement here really is a very loose coalition of nonprofit groups. That's who they're really turning to get people out into the streets. Mm-hmm. And that inevitably means that you don't have a lot of very, very narrow agreement on issues. It takes them a long time to figure out how to respond to government issues. Now, all that said, everything here has been so peaceful that I don't think anybody is suggesting, at least in the near term, a Tiananmen Square-style crackdown, because, first of all, it's not like you've got any daily large group of people in the streets to crack down on. You've had three extraordinarily well-organized, well-disciplined rallies. I confess I was surprised when I was at the July 13th rally here to see the Van Cleef and Arpels jewelry store showing diamond jewelry in their store window to this very large crowd, and there was a Rolls-Royce showroom behind the stage.
So this was no mob.
In many countries, you wouldn't trust a mob. In fact, even in the United States, they might. If you had that large a crowd on Broadway, people might roll down their steel shutters if they were a jewelry store or a Rolls-Royce dealership. But they had the steel shutters, and they chose not to roll them down because these have been such well-behaved middle-class and even upper-middle-class crowds.
So it's been well-behaved, but Veron Hong, is Beijing worried about the ideas that are being taken to the streets in Hong Kong, filtering into China proper?
Of course they are worried. They worry about the spillover effects in China. If they allow direct elections in Hong Kong, they allow more democracy in Hong Kong, because they're afraid of making too many concessions within a short time, because that will make the Chinese leadership look very weak. They also worry that citizens on the mainland will follow Hong Kong people to demand what they want by staging large-scale demonstrations. Having said that, though, I think all of us should pay attention to what have happened over the past 2 days in Hong Kong, and Beijing should welcome that, because on Wednesday, as you mentioned at the very beginning of the show, mm-hmm. Tong accepted the resignations of two most unpopular ministers in Hong Kong.
Who were quite close to Beijing, or seen as close to Beijing.
Yeah, well, one is actually the financial secretary. He was embroiled in a scandal about his purchase of a car just weeks before he announced raising automobile taxes. Another one is Security Secretary Regina Ip. Right. She had spearheaded efforts to pass controversial national security law.
So they're out, which must be bringing some satisfaction to the protesters.
That's correct. That's the reason why I think, Beijing should welcome that. And to some extent, these actions can dampen the public's anger towards the government now. However, the anger is likely to rise if the replacements for these two ministers do not command respect. So that's why I say, for the coming weeks, it's very important. Another thing happened is actually earlier today, Tong held a press conference addressing for the first time the public, the political unrest in Hong Kong. He basically made four important points. He admitted making mistakes in the past 6 years, and then he promised to adopt a modest, open and sincere attitude to win the public's trust and support. He also announced that the government would launch another round of territory-wide consultations on this controversial national security law.
Right.
And finally, he said, the Hong Kong's health minister would not head the SARS inquiry group. At issue is this. The health minister has been criticized for mishandling the SARS outbreak, and Mr. Tong was criticized for letting him head the group to investigate his own mistakes.
But Ruan Hong, let's hold it right there. I think we've got Richard Baum back. I'm sorry we lost you, Richard Baum, but I think that SARS epidemic, which so famously hit Hong Kong early on, I'm guessing this is part of the perfect storm that you were about to describe when we lost you there.
It was to change metaphors, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. You had a lot of things leading up to this. You had the Hong Kong economic crisis of 1997-98. You have the property market tanking. You have real estate values tanking. You have the stock market tanking. You have unemployment triple its high rates of the 1990s. So you have, an economic crisis that hasn't gone away.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a chief executive who is not popularly selected and not accountable to the people of Hong Kong, and he has acted aloof and not terribly effectively as chief executive. And then you have, on top of all of this, you have two enabling conditions. You have the SARS crisis, which killed tourism, as if Hong Kong needed another economic blow.
A big
industry. Finally, you have the worst timing of all with this Article 23 legislation, which just, I think, stirred the whole mixture into a flammable cocktail.
This is the internal security proposal.
Yes.
The toughened internal security proposal. So with all that, does this look manageable to you, Richard Baum, or does Beijing have something it doesn't know what to do with here? Veron Hong pointed out they're still effectively in the midst of a transition of administrations in Beijing. It's a country where leaders cannot afford to look weak, particularly when it comes to party control. Do they have the latitude they need to deal with this, or is this likely to flare up further?
Well, I certainly don't think that the two resignations are going to put an end to the popular demands for greater responsiveness in Hong Kong. Indeed, probably nothing less than the resignation of C.H. Tung is going to put a damper on popular unhappiness. On the other hand, Tung last night said that he wasn't going to resign, which is too bad, because He's going to Beijing this weekend, and maybe they could invent an illness for him that would enable him to resign and save everybody a little bit of face. That would certainly be the best way out of this. It wouldn't solve the problems. The economy is not going to be improved by his resignation. But if there were to be a caretaker appointed in his place, say a man like Chief Executive Donald Tsang, who has the respect and credibility on all sides of this Hong Kong problem, I think you might be able to work your way out of this mess. But if Tsang says in advance he's not resigning, and Beijing says in advance he's our man, then I don't think this problem is going to go away easily.
Richard Baum, Keith Bradshaw pointed out earlier that Hong Kong has historically been a base for dissent that would emanate into China. Sun Yat-sen spent time there, and so did some of the Communist Party leaders, others as well. Do you see it filling that role today? Which way has the needle gone since China took over in 1997? Hong Kong's become more like China, or China's become more worried about the kind of independent virus, at least, independent-mindedness of Hong Kong?
There's always been that concern. Early on, Jiang Zemin warned Hong Kong, using the analogy of river water and well water. The river water shouldn't poison the well water, and the well water shouldn't poison the river water. At that point, he was more concerned about Hong Kong poisoning China, although people in Hong Kong were worried about the reverse. But I don't think that China has used a heavy hand in its relations with Hong Kong under the One Country, Two Systems program. I think to a certain extent, Hong Kong's government has been its own worst enemy. Some of these people in high cabinet positions like Regina Ip and Anthony Leung, and also perhaps Elsie Leung, are not particularly impressive or effective administrators, and C.H. Tung himself is aloof and ineffective. So I think that the government has not done what it could in Hong Kong to alleviate the problem, and there is a perception of inadequacy, perception of great incompetence.
I want to invite our callers in. Listeners, you can join this conversation. Should Washington take a stand for democracy in Hong Kong? And if Beijing can't tolerate a little democracy in Hong Kong, does China have a hope of ever going peacefully democratic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Andrew's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to ask whether the central government suppression of pro-democracy activists, Falun Gong practitioners, Tibetans, and Uyghurs.
We lost me with Uyghur. What's that one, Andrew?
The Uyghur Autonomous Region in Xinjiang in western China.
All right.
Whether their suppression of all these groups can be used to revoke the Olympic Games from Beijing in 2008, or what kinds of sanctions and pressures can be placed on the government to make any sort of internationally acceptable changes in the country.
Well, that raises a bunch of interesting questions. Andrew, thanks for calling in. Keith Bradshaw, let me turn to you. You're watching Beijing from Hong Kong. What are the international leverage points here, if any? What does China care about abroad when it comes to its treatment of Hong Kong? Are the Olympics a leverage point? Are there others? What about Taiwan?
I think there's a long list of things that that China cares about. Certainly, you raised Taiwan. Efforts to persuade Taiwan to at some point accept some form of even loose political affiliation with China have certainly been hurt by the image among many Taiwanese that Hong Kong people have become bitterly unhappy and concerned about loss of freedom since China took over here. As far as the Olympics are concerned, certainly there were a lot of concerns expressed about China's human rights record before Beijing was awarded the Olympics, and it did receive it anyway. So short of something happening that greatly raises international concern, I don't know whether that would be whether that decision would be revisited.
Mm-hmm. Viren Hung, you're in Washington watching this unfold. Is this on the radar screen in Washington at all?
Well, actually, I'm going to organize an event comment on the political unrest in Hong Kong. And so far, we receive a lot of people expressing interest in understanding what's going on in Hong Kong. And actually, we are going to address one question, well, an issue, what Washington can do to express concern about what's going on in Hong Kong without upsetting China. And that would be difficult because actually, China has been very outspoken about this. They claim that this is total internal affairs in China. No foreign governments should speak anything about this. However, I think if anything, Washington can talk about the situation in Hong Kong, it would be the best way for them is to focus what is provided clearly in the basic law, because this is what Chinese government promised. I think they should highlight that, hey, Chinese government actually promised Hong Kong and give them an option to have a chance to elect their chief executive. So then I think, well, the best way for Washington to address the issue in Hong Kong is to fall within the confines set by the basic law. Otherwise, it will invite a lot of criticisms.
Appeal to their sense of fairness. A promise is a promise. Richard Baum, what's your sense of where leverage might lie here?
I just totally don't agree with the last comment. I think the United States government has demanded of China vis-a-vis Hong Kong that it respect the Constitution under the one country, two systems formula, and that it allow Hong Kong a great deal of autonomy, which it has done. The current emergency in Hong Kong has very little to do with Beijing breaking its promises. It has everything to do with incompetence and bad fortune in Hong Kong.
But isn't the sense that Tung Chee Hwa is essentially a representative, not to say tool, of Beijing, not to say
but
a running dog?
But the basic law is the Constitution, and he is governing within the basic law. The elected legislature or semi-elected legislature in Hong Kong is impotent because of the nature of the basic law. It was built into the system. It is the Constitution. It is not a violation of the Constitution. It is the Constitution. It is the rule of law. That can be changed, but it can only be changed with great difficulty.
Nevertheless, he's headed to Beijing this weekend. I mean,
right.
The buck does stop there.
Beijing.
Right. So the buck stops there.
Right.
Is there leverage that Beijing is likely to feel, or are they really and truly going to consider this primarily as an internal matter?
I think they would love him to resign, but I don't know how much pressure they are going to be able to exert on him at this point with a great deal of face at stake. He has said he won't resign, and that makes it very difficult for Beijing to force his hand.
It may be more than they can pull off,
given
the box that he's built. We're talking tonight about mighty China's trouble with little Hong Kong and the future of democracy in the shadow of Beijing. My guests, Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief of the New York Times, Veron Hong, fellow at the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Richard Baum at UCLA. You can join the conversation. Have you been paying attention here? Did you know that Hong Kong just turned out the biggest protest rally in China since Tiananmen in 1989? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about mighty China's trouble with little Hong Kong and the future of democracy in the shadow of Beijing. My guests are Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. Joining us from Washington, Veron Hong. She's a fellow at the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And from UCLA, director of the Center for Chinese Studies and professor of political science, Richard Baum. You can join the conversation as well. Can you see why Beijing is afraid of open politics in the former British colony? Could Hong Kong infect all of China with the democracy virus? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Keith Bradshaw, I wish you'd give our listeners a sense of the interaction that goes on, that's gone on since 1997 between Hong Kong and China mainland or proper, both physically and culturally. Hong Kong is part of China now formally, but there's still what looks very much like an international border there, is there not?
There is an international border, but it's also the world's most crossed international border. You have 4 million people a month crossing that border. Now, some of that is people commuting, but a lot of that is just a tremendous flow of people and therefore information and ideas mm-hmm. across that border. It doesn't take long to get there. It's an hour from the downtown business district of Hong Kong, and it takes about half an hour or an hour, depending on how inefficient the border procedures are, and then you're in. They have some restrictions on visas, but other than for journalists, really, it has become very easy to cross that border.
And the integration is very casual and deep at some levels. I have Hong Kong friends who have second homes in Beijing and who have spa memberships there and go over to spend a day by a pool.
Absolutely. People are constantly crossing that border are flying up to Beijing for a Hong Kong permanent resident, it becomes very easy. They have a card. They don't even need to use a passport to cross that border or to go elsewhere in the mainland. It is a level of integration, both political, cultural, and economic, that rises by the day. And in many ways, actually, the political system is the least integrated in the sense of this one country, two systems rule for keeping the political systems separate. Everything else, you look at the economy, Hong Kong's economy now basically is trade and is finance and other services for trade with China. It's an entrepot for a lot of the goods coming out of China. Hong Kong and the adjacent ports in the Pearl River Delta handled just about as many freight containers as all the ports in the United States last year, because the 60-mile radius around Hong Kong is the export hub and the manufacturing hub of China, although some people say Shanghai could catch up by the end of the decade.
Of China and maybe the planet. Of all that traffic between Hong Kong and the mainland, what are the people, what are the ideas that concern Beijing the most, Keith Bretcher?
Well, Hong Kong people have the experience of being able to speak their minds, of having multiple political parties, even though the political parties can't really campaign for the top job, the chief executive mm-hmm. office job, since that's effectively or close to effectively appointed still. But there is certainly a much greater freedom here, The question has always been, to what extent do people in China compare themselves to people in Hong Kong? Hong Kong was a separately administered and separate national territory even for so long that you do find in China people still viewing it as sort of a strange and alien place. And
Though appealing. Company. I mean, the fence between Hong Kong and China mainland is to keep Chinese people from flooding in.
Well, it has been that. Now, in the last several years, there's actually been a real concern about Hong Kong people flooding out, oddly enough, not because they don't want to have their Hong Kong citizenship, but rather because they would live just across the border in Shenzhen and commute to jobs here if you were to really open up the borders and make it easier. Also, there's been a concern that because real estate prices and so forth are much lower in Shenzhen, that a lot of the big stores there are much cheaper, and the Hong Kong store owners and the property developers who get the rent for those stores don't mm-hmm. want everybody to be doing their shopping in just across the border. So it's odd that now there's at least as much pressure from within Hong Kong not to remove that border. This is a peculiar situation in which you basically got Manhattan prices yeah. in Hong Kong, whether it's for food, whether it's for apartment rents and so forth, right next door to one of the world's the world's most populous and in many ways still very inexpensive country, and keeping that border there.
The country that stocks Walmart, right. Richard Baum,
exactly.
Take the long view here, if you would. You know the slow pace of liberalization that I think is a fair characterization of how the Chinese Communist Party has looked at the world, despite everything going on in China. You know the kind of natural expectations of Hong Kong people. When you look at Hong Kong's likely impact on China, and there are many, of course, impacts on China, but when you look at Hong Kong's over time and look at the low receptivity in Beijing, is there a collision course here? Or is it possible that China's politics and Hong Kong's politics might naturally sort of meet and converge?
I think that's a very interesting question, and it's also a question relevant to current developments on Taiwan. where it seems that economically and even slowly politically there is a convergence of sorts that is beginning to happen. But in Hong Kong, I think the threat to China is not so much that Hong Kong is going to poison or pollute the politics of China. I think the problem is that Hong Kong presents a challenge to China that they don't know how to deal with, except in traditional terms, which is basically you either ignore a problem or you crush it. And I think that's that is China's dilemma right now. They don't want to crush anything in Hong Kong. They don't want to have any political repression that's going to affect their relations with Taiwan, which is, after all, a bigger prize, perhaps, the future of reunification. So the Chinese are genuinely in a dilemma here. There is a secular process of gradual political change and social change occurring in China. It's occurring from the ground up, not from the top down, but it's very real and it's very detectable. A new civil society is emerging in many places in China. There are huge problems there, economic problems, unemployment, HIV/AIDS, corruption, inequality of income. You can go on forever, but it's a dynamic society. There is a middle class emerging. There are 200 million cell phones in China. There are 42 million satellite dishes. There are 10 million private automobiles. This is an emerging middle class society, at least in the cities, maybe not in the remote countryside yet. So there is change occurring, and so I don't think the Chinese need to build a fortress around themselves to keep Hong Kong's ideas out. I think what they need to do is avoid a crisis in Hong Kong as long as they can.
Verrod Hong, let me put the same question to you. From your perspective, do you think the politics of Hong Kong and China can, within some foreseeable period, converge? Or is Hong Kong always going to be the kind of odd duck in the Chinese political realm?
Well, it really depends on how the new leaders in China will do. Because right now we understand that the former president, Jiang Zemin, still have an up hand over the current president, Hu Jintao. And in fact, in September or October, the Communist Party is going to discuss whether China's constitution should be amended to include former President Jiang Zemin's so-called three represents theory.
Three represents this kind of effort to integrate capitalism with communist principles.
That's correct. This is a somewhat awkward or unconvincing effort to integrate these two, capitalism with the communist principles. The fact that they actually has the plan to incorporate Jiang Zemin's three represents theory into the state's constitution shows that, Jiang still retains enormous power and still a very influential leader.
Does that mean that Hu Jintao has limited scope to respond to what's going on politically here, that Jiang Zemin is looking over his shoulder, still really holds the reins?
That's true. As long as, since your question actually is framed as in the foreseeable future. So we have to ask, if Jiang still retains control and still maintains his influence, it will be very difficult for Hu Jintao and the more open-minded leaders to make changes. So certainly it will be too risky for Hu to have conflict with Jiang Zemin when Jiang plays such an important role. So I think Hu Jintao will act very, very cautiously. And that's the reason why in handling the political crisis in Hong Kong, the new leaders, Hu Jintao, has to be cautious. And then on the other hand, they also need to worry about if Tong is going to step down, then that may be perceived as failure of one country, two systems. Such failure will also give Taiwan a strong reason to reject any plan to reunify with the mainland. So that also will look very badly on the new leadership.
So that would not reflect well. Keith Bradshaw, Richard Baum said earlier, he characterized China's as having had a light touch in Hong Kong since reunification in 1997, which may be true. Yet I have to say, friends in Hong Kong report that the sense of a kind of chill very quickly after 1997, that things did and have changed in a way that's quite notable to longtime residents there. What's your sense of how light or heavy-handed, how much impact China has had since 97 on Hong Kong life and culture, view of the world, the way things work?
It's very indirect. You never see, for example, any People's Liberation Army soldiers except, I guess, guarding the gates to the barracks way out in the new territories. They're not even allowed, in fact, to be to walk in uniform in the streets when they're off duty or anything else. But there is an indirect effect in the sense that little by little people are becoming more and more conscious that they are part of China. I think that where you see that most visibly is in self-censorship in the media, which has become much more cautious towards China. One of the interesting things, and towards Beijing, one of the interesting things to watch here is how it's not just the democracy movement that says, look, this is only about events in Hong Kong, we want to change Hong Kong, we're not out to threaten the central government in Beijing. Mm. The media has been very willing to run caustic criticisms often of Teng Chih-hua, the chief executive here, but says very little critical of Beijing. And that may be one reason, in fact, that in polls, Beijing leaders actually do better than Hong Kong leaders. Now, it also helps that because the mainland has had much faster economic growth over the last, certainly over the last decade and really over the last two decades in many ways than Hong Kong, people see the mainland in a much more positive light than they used to.
It's the golden goose. And what about the Communist Party? The actual presence in Hong Kong, do the mucky mucks visit? Do they like what they see? Do they, I don't know, do they have penthouses in Hong Kong?
A lot of them do, but they're very low profile about that. In terms of official visits, we did indeed have the Prime Minister, Premier Wen Jiabao, come here on June 29th, July 1st. And he signed then the Hong Kong Mainland China Free Trade Agreement. Now, it shows you both how far apart Hong Kong and China still are that they even had to have a free trade agreement. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he was really welcomed here. The crowds that turned out for him were the sort that you wouldn't see for a pro Beijing government minister. He actually had more of a touch for the crowds in terms of kissing babies and visiting the apartment complex where the greatest number of SARS cases took place. Mm-hmm. He had more of a common touch for that than Teng Chih-hua has.
More than the local man.
Teng almost seems to be following his example when we had a terrible bus crash here a week ago, in which a double-decker bus hit a truck, went up on the guardrail of a mountain road, and then fell nose first 100 feet down a cliff.
Ouch.
Teng was there within a couple of hours and was there sort of rolling up his sleeves and making a point of showing that he showed sympathy for the large number of casualties and it was just very visible in a way that we haven't always seen him.
Well, there may be a kind of political touch being encouraged by everything that's going on. We're out of time with that, but Keith Bradshaw, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Keith Bradshaw is Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And Richard Baum in Irvine, California, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
A pleasure, Tom.
Richard Baum is Director of the Center for Chinese Studies at University of California, Los Angeles, and author of Reform and Reaction in Post-Mao China, The Road to Tiananmen. And Veron Hong in Washington, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Good to have you. Veron Hong is a fellow at the China Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's a consultant for the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.